you're very welcome to another episode of Sparking Change. I'm Dilip Vikramasinghe. Thank you for taking the time to catch up with the latest social justice and mental health stories as you speak to those who are affected by the issues and hear from the change makers who are making a real difference, all with the view, of course, to inspire you to be part of the change. Please remember to subscribe, rate and review us, and do get in touch with the show by emailing us on sparkingchange@headstuff.org or follow me on Twitter @DilW or the show @SparkingChange1. Now, a word from our sponsor. Our mental health is our most precious resource. How we feel about ourselves plays a big part in the job that we have, the quality of our relationships and our resilience to cope with the challenges of life. Insight Matters provides inclusive and affordable mental health support services with a dedicated and talented team of 45 psychotherapists. Call us on 01-891-0703 or visit insightmatters.ie and start your journey of self-discovery. If you'd like to advertise on Sparking Change and reach thousands of engaged listeners, do get in touch. When it comes to looking after our mental health, there are many things one can do. Practicing self-care, mindfulness, eating and sleeping well, exercising. Well, these are just a few things one can do to maintain their well-being. But one tip that doesn't often get mentioned is self-awareness. Knowing who you really are plays a big part in creating an authentic and contented life. Well, one way of becoming self-aware is enlisting the help of a counselor or a psychotherapist. But there are so many out there. How do you go about finding the right one for you? And what can you expect from the experience of talking about your issues with a total stranger? Well, joining me here on Sparking Change is counselor and psychotherapist Amy Plant. Welcome to Sparking Change, Amy.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
So one question I always like to ask psychotherapists and counselors when I first meet them is like, what made you want to become a counselor?
Oh, yeah, that's kind of, it's sort of a... You know, it's not a weird story, but I was kind of an eternal student. So I decided that I wanted to kind of start my journey on studying to be a counselor and psychotherapist when I was already in the process of actually studying for another degree. So what happened was I was studying photography in IADT kind of years ago, and I was in my final year, and I had already decided, I think, you know, probably halfway through my course, that it wasn't really for me, and it wasn't totally finding fulfillment in it. But I decided to.
Photography is cool.
It's cool. Yeah,
it works for some people.
Yeah, no, totally. Yeah, greatest respect to photography. I just had discovered that it wasn't really my bag, and so. But I decided to finish it out, and I was writing my my dissertation, or I was procrastinating on writing my dissertation rather, which is, I think, is key in the writing of any dissertation. But what had happened was my father had gone back to college after 40 years out of the education system to study counselling and psychotherapy. He was kind of, you know, my mother had died recently, and he kind of experienced this huge, we all did, but he experienced this huge upheaval in his life. And he's a very, well, you know him, but he's very,
yeah,
he's
I know.
A, you know him.
Robert Plant, shout out to Robert if you're listening.
He's a very passionate person, and so he got every book I think that existed on his reading list when he started, and so I was kind
but
of
but can you just tell our listeners what does Robert do for a living?
Patrick
What does Patrick do for a living? Because this is the interesting thing. What does he do? He's a tradesperson.
Yes, yeah, he's a plumber.
A plumber.
Yeah, plumber slash counselor slash psychotherapist.
Yeah. And then when I met Paddy first, I was like,
yeah,
so you're a plumber,
yeah,
and you're a counsellor.
Yeah.
Okay, how did that happen? Because I think I could have this conversation again with him, because it's a very interesting person himself.
Yeah, definitely. He still does it, that he was a plumber and was my entire life, and did that, you know, left school to go to trade school at the age of 15. And then, as I said, just experienced a huge, you know, change, I think, as anyone would when my mom died, you know, and everything was really turned upside down for him. And so he kind of just made loads of changes. He started going to yoga, and he climbed Kilimanjaro, and he, like, you know, and he went back to college, and he did all sorts of stuff. And so, and then bought every book that existed on the reading list. He's very, as I said, passionate, kind of both feet in, doesn't do things by halves. And so I was floating around the house procrastinating on my dissertation, and was having a little route. I love to read, so I was having a little route through his stack of books. And I put my hand on what I now understand is a very famous book by a very famous psychotherapist, which is Love's Executioner by Irvin Yalom. And I picked that up, and I just, like, I devoured it. I just thought it was one of the... I was kind of surprised by it as well. I think that a lot of people have an idea of what they think therapists are like. And I had been to therapy myself when I was younger. But I was very surprised by his kind of style, and I was very surprised by his like candor and his humanity and stuff, and being very honest about himself. And I read that from cover to cover.
But it's not a clinical approach.
Not at all. Yeah. I mean, he's so...
He owns it.
Yeah, he's very, as I say, he's got a lot, he's very honest and very personable and very, quite raw. I mean, I think some of the stuff he said in it, I was like, God, like that's a bit, you know, very honest about his own judgments, essentially, like, or the way he would judge other people, or, you know, that kind of thing. And so, yeah, I read that and I just thought it was incredible. And I...
The light bulb moment.
Yeah, and I finished my degree and then went immediately into my psychotherapy certificate.
Mm-hmm. And I have to ask, what did your father say in all of this? Is like, what?
What, as in, like, what do you think you do? Just, like, get out of college? Well, like, I was going to say in his defense, but I have to say he's, all my life has been my greatest supporter. And he, like, in everything, I just, you know, I said to him, look, here's what I'm doing. And he was just like, okay, fine. He was like, good, great. He supported me throughout the entire thing.
And the gas part is, like, your primary degree, for most people, it's really not the thing that you actually end up doing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think we all have this notion of, oh, this is what we should do. And then you go and do it. And halfway through it, you're like, I'm not meant to be.
Made it terrible. I'm like, what have I done? Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But at least in fairness, you finished it. Fair play. You actually got the dissertation in.
Yeah, because I
got a skin of a teeth.
Well, yeah. And actually, the funny thing is that I ended up, because I wrote my dissertation on... I originally thought that I'd go into bereavement counselling, or, you know, I'd develop an interest in that. And I did have an interest in it, but I kind of branched off into other things. But I wrote my photography dissertation on the role of the photograph in the processing of grief and the realisation of loss. And so that was actually really interesting. It was
powerful.
Tough, but it was, yeah. And so that was part that I enjoyed writing it. I think I enjoyed writing as much as one is capable of enjoying writing a dissertation. So, yeah, I realized probably earlier on that I wanted to admit to myself that it wasn't really for me, because I think it's hard when you get into something and you think this is going to be amazing, and you think, and then you start.
And then all your friends are there, you know, they've been hanging out.
And you start to realize, oh, God, no, I've done this. And then when my mom died, they very kindly, I was towards the end of my third year, and they very kindly, my tutors were very understanding and lovely. And they offered... They said, you know, if you can defer if you want to. And I remember thinking, oh my God, no. I said, if you think I'm going to spend 5 years? No.
If I do it, I'll never come back.
No, I was like, no, I won't. Or to like attack another year on. So no, I just put my head down and I just finished it out. But yeah, I think loads of people, there's a pressure, I think, to kind of decide what you're going to do with the rest of your life when you're 21 or whatever.
Yeah, but that's huge for you to lose your mom in the middle of all of that.
Yeah.
You know, because it's traumatic anyway.
Sure.
But actually then... doing your studies after that, but yeah, incredible.
Mm.
And and then again, the other question is, okay, you studied counseling and psychotherapy, and I think I heard a statistic recently, like only about 10% of people who actually study counseling and psychotherapy go on to practice.
Really?
It's like really tiny.
Wow.
Yeah, because it's like, wow, you're setting up a practice is tough work, as you know. As you know.
Sure.
And a lot of people suddenly realize, oh my goodness, I have to approach this as a business.
Yeah.
I mean, no one is actually going to give me a job, because unfortunately, it's a kind of catch 22 situation.
Yeah, you have accreditation, and yeah, you need to be accredited in order to work with an organization, that kind of thing.
So, exactly. Yeah. And then it's not easy. And then setting up your own business, even though it's a practice, it's a business.
Yeah,
that's just really tough going. You know. So what made you think, okay, I'm going to make a go of this?
Well, I think, you know, there was a couple of things that I think I was comfortable doing it, first of all, because something that I noticed when I was in college was that a lot of, and I had heard this as well, that a lot of therapists are sort of uncomfortable with the idea of like marketing themselves, you know, and I think if you're going to...
Very common.
And as you said there, it's kind of, it is a business and you are marketing yourself because you're not working for anybody else. So you have to go private practice. And so you have to sort of, I don't want to say pick yourself up, but you have to get into that comfortable space. And I think if you think of it as what it is, rather than this kind of discomfort of it, like selling yourself or pushing something, that it's like, if you can't, like if you're not comfortable putting yourself out there, how are you supposed to be able to help anybody or reach anybody? If you consider yourself a good and effective therapist and what you're doing worthwhile, then surely it's a good thing to be able to reach as many people as you possibly can, as opposed to you sort of I think as Irish people, we have a problem like bigging ourselves up anyway. You know, I think that's like a cultural thing. But I was very much for it because by the time, as I said there, I was the eternal student. So I think what happens with a lot of other therapists is that they have, like my dad, it's like they have a job and they have a full-time job and they potentially have quite a well-paid job. And so to take the step into counselling away from this kind of safety is terrifying for people. Whereas I, fortunately or unfortunately, didn't have that. So I had had
years.
You're
a poor student.
I had had years and years of just being broke. And so was very like gung-ho and very, dedicated to kind of making it happen for myself and to kind of building my website and to kind of doing it like that. So yeah. I really put everything I had into it. But I think, yeah, you have to have that kind of comfort in. And I mean, I still experience that discomfort myself. Like I've written some things from the journal and I'm like, oh, seeing it, like I still have that Irish cringiness in me.
And you don't like seeing yourself on telly either.
Oh God, it's like that haunts me. It just never.
Sorry, Evie. I bet you're hoping whether I was going to bring this up or not. But you have to, because I think it's just lovely. Because I think people have this perception of psychotherapists being these people with no personality,
dry
exactly, and they just, you know, just sit in an office and listen to people's issues hour after hour. But you're that, there you are on the telly.
I know.
Doing roller derby.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. I know. Yeah.
You had people, and this is actually part of the air ad campaign that's on at the moment.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Yeah.
And so roller derby is something that you do. And you've been doing for a long time?
Six years.
And for people who don't know what roller derby is, what is it?
Oh God, yeah. It's like you could dedicate an entire podcast. In fact, there are many podcasts dedicated to roller derby, but explaining it.
You should start one.
It's basically in a nutshell, I suppose. It's a predominantly female. There is men's roller derby, but it's predominantly a women's sport. I suppose you describe it as a full contact sport that you play on roller skates. You play it on a flat oval track. There's no ball. And basically, there's one dedicated, there's like a person is the ball. There's on a team, there's 14 people. On a track at any time, there's 5 people from each team. 4 of those people are blockers. One of those people are what's called the jammer. And the jammer is the person who scores the points. And they score points by passing members of the opposing team. And so if you're a blocker, it is your job to help your jammer and to stop the opposing jammer.
Oh my gosh, it is full contact.
Oh, it's full contact. Yeah.
Amy!
Yes, I know.
Have you broken anything?
I have. I broke, you can see my weird little finger. I broke my little finger and I fractured my tailbone. So,
yikes!
Yeah, I know. Yeah, but to be fair, that's like good going for 6 years. A lot of people do a lot worse.
That's
so
worse.
I think I've...
Wow, so there's no ball, so you basically just have to get to the other side. Wow.
Yeah, and around, and like, yeah, and you stop or help members of your team, you know, with various parts of your body.
Surely there's rules.
Oh, of course, there's more rules. God, there's rules the length of your arm. Okay. Like, there's... That's why I was like, how do you explain it? God, it's like, there's so many rules. So many rules.
You did pretty well, and I can safely say, for me, and probably a lot of the listeners... We're never going to try it because it sounds terrifying.
Oh, it's amazing. Would recommend.
No, I go watch it. No problem. I can't watch you. But no, from a safe distance. And I'm not too sure if my kids come up to me one day, I want to do roller derby. I'm like, I don't know.
Oh, it's so much fun. So great for you in so many ways. Like I would advocate it for mental health as well.
Hilarious. No, we went at a tangent that I knew we would do. So back to the counselling element of it. Because this is... the lovely thing about counselors and psychotherapists, we're all different. Exactly, like we are all, as human beings, we're different. So you all have different approaches. So what is your approach, Amy? And I suppose, from a therapeutic point of view, who are your heroes, and how has that kind of impacted on how you are in the room with the client?
Yeah, well, I would say I was speaking to you earlier about Irvin Yalom, and I think that he was my foot in the door of therapy, you know. He's the first
guide.
Yeah, my first introduction to it, and my, as I said, even as someone who had experienced therapy, because I did go when I was younger, was kind of surprised at this, and had, as you said, there, like, people have an idea of what therapists are. And I so often have clients saying to me, like, oh, you know, you think this, or you look at, like, you know,
then Tony, show up.
Oh God, I know.
Like, sorry, visually, because obviously visually people need to know this. You've got kind of bluish, greenish hair.
Yes, yes.
Kind of like mine in most days.
Easily recognizable.
And you've got ink.
Yes.
And it's beautiful ink as
thank you.
You know?
Yes.
So it totally blows that idea off, this kind of middle-aged, dry, very prim and proper person, you know. I'd say a lot of clients coming in that probably take a big sigh, have a big sigh of relief when they see, oh, here's someone who's actually looks, someone I can relate to.
Yeah, and I think that...
And he's hip and trendy.
Yeah, I think that's that people, well, certainly obviously the clients that I encounter would like it because obviously they've come to me and they've come to me for a reason and there's a photo of me, although I don't have blue hair on my website, but, you know, that they come to me for a reason and so they are kind of made comfortable by that, you know, and I think that the more I've practiced, the more comfortable I get with even like now you're saying I'm wearing like docks and jeans and like I would still be presentable but I even would be
at the start where you're a little bit more
where I'd be a bit but I still would have and clients would often pass comment on it just in an offhand way be like you know I think I had like heart-shaped sunglasses I had them on the coffee table or the you know the table, the side table one day and a client kind of saying that to me be like you wouldn't you know if you were walking down the street no one would ever guess that you're a therapist and I was like well that's just therapists are just like you and me they just look like everybody else they're just humans you know
I think it's still connected to stigma because the other question of course I have for you is like you know because this is always a funny one you know at a social event at a party dinner party so what do you do for work what do you do Amy what do you say
yeah just tell them that I'm a therapist and here then just the awkward clinking of cutlery off plates and stuff as people begin to ignore you and turn away yeah sometimes it does it can get a bit weird you know depending, I think, and it's like you said there, I think it's associated closely with people have like a misunderstanding or an idea of what they think either a therapist or therapy is. And so sometimes when I say to people, some people go, oh, that's really cool, it's really interesting. And, you know, what's the difference between psychotherapy and this?
Are you going to psychoanalyze me?
And that always comes up. People are like, oh, my God, they'll either go, ugh, and like try and like back away or be like, oh, my God, I'll give you a job. You can analyze me all day, whatever.
No thanks.
Yeah, and I'm like, and I'll just joke with them and be like, oh, I'm off the clock, you know, lol. But also, like, if I have the energy, I will explain that it'd be like, it's not like that. It's not, and I explain this to clients as well, be like, it's not like that. It's not psychoanalysis. It's a lot more transparent and a lot more forthright and a lot more straightforward than people imagine it is, you know? So, but it does make, sometimes you go out for a few pints and people get a bit awkward about it because they think you're going to, like, I don't know, start dredging up all their issues or something.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, that's the last thing you'd want to
do. I know. I was going to say, as if I want to when I'm out for a few drinks. Like, yeah, been doing it all day.
Yeah, it's been doing it all day, exactly. It's like, you know, the chef, at the end of the day, last thing they want to do is cook, you know?
Yeah,
yeah. So it's hilarious because, unfortunately, the stigma is still there.
Of course,
and
yeah.
I suppose, what's your experience of since you started?
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that there's a lot more openness now and we can and I can tell by people talking about it more and we just seem to be more aware of the statistics and we're like okay as a country what can we do but I'd say what's your impression of how the mental health stigma has come along since you started you know your own studies your own training
Well I like to you know I like to think that it has certainly lessened because, you know, there is a lot more kind of, you know, it's okay to not be okay and all of that sort of stuff. And I think as well, you know, but it definitely does still exist. And I think to an extent, maybe I'd say I don't think I exist in a bubble, but obviously I exist in this kind of like in the field of mental health where people are quite open about it. And I think that just in the kind of in my social circles, like all of my closest friends and people that I would train with in roller derby and all that sort of stuff are very open about it, you know, really, really open about it. So my experience of it is that people at my age are a lot more comfortable. Now, some are still a bit, you know, and I do have some clients who talk about how they're like, you know, they might tell one or two friends and they're a bit, and I have some clients who wouldn't dream of telling anybody, wouldn't breathe a word of it, just wouldn't. But I do, my experience of it is that it is starting to be seen as more just good practice and just you know the same way that you would go to a lot of people are like well you'd go to the doctor if you had a cold or you know it's starting to be seen a little bit more like that I think you know
because for me I felt there was a time where in Ireland people were talking more but still you know actually picking up the phone and you know making an appointment with a therapist is still happening later than it should it's better because I feel maybe a few years ago by the time the client actually got to the therapist, they were nearly on their knees.
Yes.
Know? Where now they're a little bit earlier, but still people are not quite taking a preventative approach. It's like, I love to live in a country where people go, actually, I want to go see a counselor before I feel sick and to figure out who I am and what I want to do in my life.
Yes, yes. And I often say that to sometimes I'll have clients that'll come in on a day and they'll kind of feel okay, you know, and yet they'll show up and they'll say to me, oh, I don't know what we're going to talk about. And I say, well, you know what? Like, I think that, you know, counseling is a great opportunity for you to get to know and like cultivate your relationship with yourself, you know. And often people think that they need to come in with this massive crisis. Now, often they do. People generally don't come to tell you that everything's amazing, you know. They come to tell you that something's wrong.
Wouldn't that be great though?
Yeah, like, just like, what do you need me for? Everything's unreal. But sometimes you get some of your best and deepest work done when you're not putting out fires constantly, if you get what I mean. Some people come in, they go, I don't have a big crisis to talk to you about this week. And I'm like, well, that's fine. Like, we can, you know, we don't have to kind of lurch from one crisis to another. Like, sometimes that's necessary, of course, when there's stuff going on in your life. But you can also make great use of it when you're just trying to, like, as you say, cultivate and maintain your relationship with yourself. And
because if you do that, chances are you won't even see a crisis, unless, of course, you know, like the challenges of life throw at you, you know, but otherwise you actually get to a place where you're like, no, actually, you're navigating your life, you're in a job that you like, you're in a relationship that you are, you know, you're treated with respect, you surround yourself with friends and people that again treat you well, you know, so you can actually avoid a whole crisis. I think that's where we need to get to.
Yes,
get people to see counselors before any of that. Like, I often think as teenagers.
Oh my god, like, absolutely.
Imagine you had gone to see a counselor when you were a teenager. Wouldn't that be so cool? Actually, you did.
I went, well, I was 20, and by then I was sort of like, I was like in that particular stage of my life where I was like, who am I, what am I doing, where am I going, sort of like vibrating with anxiety, which I, you know, I think is quite in some ways standard for that age. But I do know younger siblings of friends and stuff like that who had the opportunity to see counsellors in school, and you can really see the difference in the way they are with life and the way they treat themselves and the way they interact. And like, I just think when you think about the stuff, and I think back now, it's been a while since I've been out of secondary school, I'll admit, but some of the stuff that they essentially waste your time with, when you could be learning about this, about, you could be learning about your relationship with yourself, you could be learning about self-esteem, you could be learning about healthy relationships, all of that stuff, it would be like huge.
Yeah, the thing, imagine all the people that you dated who didn't treat you well.
I was only having that conversation with someone the other day. Be like, oh, if only I'd,
exactly.
I think that's true. Yeah,
all the jobs that you did
but you didn't have. And that's the thing, I think that's self-esteem, it's like, it's so key. I was saying that to a friend of mine the other day, actually. We were laughing because I was saying that we were both kind of lamenting and saying like, oh god, you know, going out with this person when you're a teenager and that person and all of these mad relationships
and
all the crap you put up and all these mad boundaries and stuff that didn't exist essentially. And I was saying that, you know, I would almost advocate, it's like that there should be an age, like you shouldn't be like an interrelationship until you're like, you know, 25 or something. And he was saying that his mother used to say, you can have a girlfriend when you're 35. And I was like, I kind of think that maybe she was onto something. Might be a bit
excessive, yeah.
Bit severe. But I mean, I understand the sentiment. I think that you ought to really get to know yourself, because when you try to find fulfillment through another person, it's a very slippery slope.
I know, because like especially now with all the... There's some great things happening in the world, you know, the hashtag MeToo campaign. Mm-hmm. And then, because a big referendum coming up very soon. And then the whole Belfast rape case, you know. Suddenly... many survivors of sexual violence, I was very upset that day when the verdict came out. But then there's been this amazing conversation out of it.
Yes.
You know, and suddenly the word consent, you know, people are realizing, my goodness, you know, we really have to have a conversation about this. Because as teenagers, we didn't know anything about consent. We were like, if you love me, you sleep with me. And it's like, oh, okay.
Yeah, is that how it works? Okay, cool. Yeah.
Yeah,
all
right,
the things
you
that
say?
You're sort of coerced and yeah.
Well, now at least these conversations are happening, but all that is connected to your self-worth, because you feel you have a strong sense of self-worth. You're like, no, actually, that's not how it's going to work.
Mm-hmm.
Get away. Mm-hmm. I mean, you creep. But I think there's great conversations. And then of course, I know you've talked about social media.
Mm-hmm.
In your article in the journal, because when I think about the young people today, the one thing that we didn't have growing up, I certainly didn't have it, and I'm older than you, but is social media.
Mm-hmm.
And for young people, how it's like everything is just magnified.
Mm.
Thankfully, when I was young, if I made a mistake,
I know, it
wasn't in color on Facebook.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. That I there was. I don't think I had MySpace and Bebo and stuff. Although I never had a Bebo.
Oh, so Bebo!
I never had one. Thankfully, because they started. Apparently, you could get all your old Bebo pictures back, and I was like, God, never have I been so pleased that that never happened for me. But yeah, it's like you said, that it kind of was a later advent in my life. And as you said, if you made a mistake, and of which, like, certainly in my teenage years, there were many. Like, you were, like...
Which is part of it.
Yeah, of course. And you're persecuted with embarrassment. And, oh my God, the thought of going into school the next day. But then it all blows over. And now it just doesn't seem to do that. Mm-hmm. So it adds a whole different dimension of... And, like, this... And I know this from, like, younger clients. You know, seeing how unreal people's lives are. You know, it's like your Facebook is, like, your highlight reel. And so it's kind of all of these feelings of inadequacy and stuff. Now, it's also amazing. I don't like to kind of really jump on the bandwagon of... Because social media and, like, the internet, it's, like, it's also incredible for keeping in touch with people and has given us lots of great things. Lots of great things. But, like, with any new advent, it has its own kind of challenges. And I think it's a totally different dimension for kids and teenagers and stuff who are alive now who've never known a world without that, you know? Because I've had kind of both. So I think I still have what I would consider a healthy amount of skepticism of that kind of thing.
And you can switch off.
But I'm not totally frightened of it. Yeah.
But you can switch off. Mm. Where I think teenagers, when they're now becoming adults, who they're immersed in social media, yeah, it must be so difficult to take a week off or a month off. It's like it's unheard of because you're so enmeshed into it, you know? Mm-hmm. Somebody was saying about before when you went away on holidays, you would maybe... call your parents, you know, once a week, once a month, or send them a postcard.
Yeah.
But now, call them on a daily basis.
Yeah.
Or have something up on Facebook. Are you okay? You're over in Australia. Who are you talking to?
Yeah. Or the last, I always talk to, like, you know, clients about this. It's like the new dimension of relationship, considerations is that kind of last active or last seen or the blue ticks on WhatsApp. You know, it's like I can
checked
see
in.
You saw my message but you didn't like write back, and it's like, oh God, it's another added dimension of like being able to constantly see where someone is or when they've last been active or when they've last looked at their phone. It's like you can kind of always know what somebody's at. Mm-hmm. People always know what you're at.
Amy, do you have any concerns in, I suppose, the way we live our life and just society in general and how it impacts negatively on our mental health?
I suppose I have a couple. The one that kind of springs to mind initially is body image, or like body, you know, pressure in a body image sense, or pressure to look a certain way. You know, especially for now, I mean, I don't doubt that, men have pressures as well, but I think especially as it kind of pertains to women and young girls and that sort of stuff. Like even the other day, a couple of weeks ago, I was sitting in my car, just sort of absentmindedly listening to the radio. And you know, when you're not really kind of aware of what you're listening to or whatever, and there was a segment or whatever you want to call it, and the whole thing was about Victoria Beckham, you know, like Posh Spice, and about the fact that she had, about her birthday cake, or more specifically, she had a watermelon instead of a birthday cake. And there was
what?
And that's all fine, whatever. But it was just a whole segment. And I kind of, it was almost over by the time I realised I was listening to you. They were talking about, she had a watermelon birthday cake. And they talked about how many calories are in a slice of watermelon as opposed to a slice of cake. And they said, you know, the former Spice Girl, who is a size 6? And then just went on, and there was this whole segment just about this, about her birthday cake and about all the calories that are in a cake as opposed to melon. And I had heard the whole thing before I even realised what I was listening to. And like, that's kind of, there's so much stuff that's like that. I mean, I think that pressures to look a certain way is, it can be very direct, but it's also really indirect. And so all of these things kind of, you hear and you see all of these things and you're not even aware of them. And it starts from a really super young age, you know?
Because there's young people who probably heard that segment or already knew about it in some magazine, and they're thinking, oh, I really shouldn't eat cake now.
Yeah.
I'm going to have watermelons.
Yeah, or just the idea that it was like, you know, saying her name, you know, if you're trying to make a former Spice Girl, who is this particular size? Just like real kind of offhanded. I just thought it was so strange. And there's all these things that happen and yet we take them as totally normal. Like even if you think about the fact that there's a, you know, you can see like there's a woman in a bikini on like a box of Special K, like on a cereal box, you know. And even today, actually, I was walking through Penny's and they have more, there's like photos of models and they have more varying body sizes, I suppose, for probably the first time. Like I stopped and I looked and I was like, that's actually the first time I think I've seen that, that there was like, just, I don't want to say regular size because there is no regular size, but just a more varied size to what you'd be typically used to looking at.
Diversity in body shapes, yeah.
And I was like surprised because it's, you know.
Because I think you have another bugbear around our, because you work with a lot of young people.
Yeah,
right. Another concern that you have is around our education system.
Yeah, I think the pressure of our education system, you know, that like the Leaving Cert and that sort of stuff is kind of sold to kids in school as like the end of the world and the biggest thing ever, and that you ought to know. I just think expecting someone to know what they want to do with the rest of their life and suggesting that they should know what they want to do with the rest of their life when they're 16, 17, 18, I just think is outrageous. It's too much pressure. And like, even if you look at the school systems in like Finland and stuff like that, where they have like less hours, less homework, and the kids are way happier, you know.
Yeah, and academically they're actually doing way better than our kids. But is it really interesting that nothing has changed? Because I remember when I failed my junior cert, my O-levels, I genuinely thought that was the end of my life, you know, because everybody was like, that's it, you'll never be able to get a job, you'll amount to nothing. And this was like the 30 years ago. And it's so sad that message is still very present.
Yeah, yeah. And it sticks with you as well. I mean, I have clients who are well into adulthood who remember things that teachers told them, you know what I mean? That like, you'll never do this, you'll never go to university, you'll never whatever. And it stays with you. Like, you know, it really, really sticks with them and kind of limits them in their, you know, belief in their abilities and stuff like that. So
how, because a lot of people say, oh, well, the education system, you know, has worked for so many, you know, it never did me any harm, you know, like some people will say that. But
sure.
But what do you see in the therapy space and how it impacts on our young people and I suppose their own sense of self and their self-worth?
Mm-hmm. Well, this is the pressure is immense. You know, I have a client who, you know, I have clients who talk about suicide, and that's not even being alarmist or exaggerating, that the pressure that they feel is so massive that they have suicidal thoughts and they become plagued with anxiety and fears about the future and all of that sort of stuff. So I just think, and I mean, I know that obviously when you're younger and you're a teenager, your resilience and stuff is slightly different to when you're an adult, but even so, I think the pressure of like a huge big memory test that's going to supposedly dictate the entire course of your life is just and then in the same breath to be wondering why teenagers and stuff are so stressed out and so anxious, I just think it's kind of, you know, ironic maybe, I don't know.
No, because I just think at the age of 44, I don't think I could cope with that kind of pressure.
Yeah.
Never mind when you're 16, when you have absolutely no coping skills or resilience in yourself.
And it is the big, you know, that it's, I'm always very careful when I talk to teenagers who are doing the Leaving Cert, that I'm kind of understanding of the pressure that they feel, so I'm not just another person that's saying, oh, you'll be okay, you know, it's grand, it'll all be over soon, but also to try and deliver that message to them in a gentle way as well. I'd be like, that it isn't the end of the world, that there is, like, it's probably one of the biggest things that they've ever faced in their sort of quite young life, but it's not the end of the world, that there's a way around everything, that you'll be fine, you know, regardless of what happens with the Leaving Cert. I was.
What kind of areas do you work in, mm-hmm. in from a, I mean, I'm sure you do general stuff.
Yeah, I do.
Is there any areas that you kind of have particularly interest in?
Yeah, I think that I'm particularly interested in, and I have sort of gravitated towards a few different areas just in a kind of like an organic way, in the sense that it's curious how certain things will kind of come your way, even, you know, kind of several different clients, and it's quite curious. So, I mean, obviously anxiety and depression are the things that kind of, they're just kind of everywhere, you know, anxiety in particular, I've found. But also something that has kind of come my way and that I have a lot of interest in is working with trauma and PTSD and that kind of thing. And also couples counselling is something that I kind of do a reasonable amount of now, and that I do.
I didn't know that.
Have an interest in. There you go. Every day's a school day. Yeah, that's something that has kind of that has come my way, that I trained in, and that I find. I mean, it's interesting and it's different to individual counselling, of course, but I find it very interesting. And yeah, also working with trauma, that is something that has just kind of been continuously sort of coming up and coming my way.
Interesting. Mm. And what do you do for your self-care? Because, you know, just these are, you know, cause as you pointed out earlier on, no client comes to you saying, oh, my life is great, I love everything is amazing. Yeah. So like today you had four mm-hmm. clients mm-hmm. here in Insight Matters. Mm-hmm. And what do you do to look after yourself? I know you have your roller derby.
Yeah, that's a big thing. And yeah, roller derby would be a kind of major thing that I would participate in, that I would consider really good for my self-care, because people often think this sounds weird, but I find it meditative. Some people say how is something that's like a really ostensibly not violent, but quite a rough sport, be meditative. And I was like, well, it's one of the only opportunities I get to sort of, you know, I think it's very rare that you get to do something and you totally concentrate all of your energy on it. You're always kind of thinking about other things, or at least I am. I'm very like, you know, a million miles a minute. And so to have an activity where my brain and my body in it are all doing the same thing and there's no space to think about something else, that's really meditative for me. And
that's so funny. You say it never struck me as someone whose mind is going at a million miles a minute.
I know. I project.
You always strike me as a very calm, very together. It's so interesting.
Oh, together. That's hilarious. No,
you're like a duck, you know.
Yeah,
or
paddling
swan.
Furiously.
Yeah.
Well, I think that
very
I'm kind
graceful.
Of, I think that I'm a relaxed person, but I think it's because I'm relaxed about the fact that, yeah, I don't think anybody has it all together, or at least I don't, you know, I don't in, I suppose it depends on your definition of what that is, but I think that I do have that kind of relaxedness, but I'm always, you know, I have a tendency to kind of think about lots of different things or kind of jump from one thing to another or be, you know, so to be able to kind of focus my mind really helps me.
Roller derby does that.
Helps me, yeah. Roller derby.
It's your survival depends on it.
Sounds weird, but, and then also I'm very conscious of that kind of self-care and like I go to my own personal therapy, so that's something that I get a huge amount out of, but I still do that. And yeah, then I'm just very conscious of my relationship with myself and how I treat myself and if things are kind of, you know, of what I can take and if things are getting too much for me and all of that sort of stuff. So just to be, because I think, well, certainly I can, and I've heard it from other counsellors, there's a tendency to, I'm quite good at compartmentalizing or getting on with things, and I think therapists are quite like that. You hold a lot and it's very easy to forget the ways in which things affect you, and it's really important to be kind of aware of that, you know. So I do, like I said, like sports, my own personal therapy, that kind of thing.
And it's funny because you were saying about, you know, you work on your relationship with yourself. Mm-hmm. How is Ireland, because you kind of alluded it to it earlier, mm-hmm. culturally speaking, mm-hmm. Irish people are, you know, quirky in certain ways. And I know another piece that you wrote for the journal, which said, you love yourself. is the one thing in Ireland that is regarded as an insult.
Oh, it's a huge insult. Like, you're constantly under pressure to prove how much you don't love yourself in Ireland. You know, it's
self-deprecation,
like,
and everything.
It's an insult. Yeah. Say, oh, you love yourself. Your man loves yourself. No, I don't. Like, it's such a weird thing to say to a person, I think.
And what's wrong with loving myself again?
Yeah.
So where do you think that comes from?
Oh, God, I don't know. And I mean, this is sort of obviously, like, I've been plenty of places in the world, but Ireland is the place that I've lived my whole life. And so, I mean, maybe it exists in other places, but I have just found it curious. And I think it's only when you start to kind of get a perspective, you know, and the work I'm doing and stuff, that you realise that you're like, God, that's a weird thing. So where it comes from, I don't know, but I do know that it seems to me to be pretty deeply entrenched. Mm-hmm. Like every person I know, all my personal relationships, and then like so many of my clients I have found, and this is like an area of interest that has come up for me just, again, as I say, organically, because so much of what kind of has people in here talking to me circles back to their relationship with themselves. And also people have this very curious, they almost see it as this kind of separate thing that I often have people talking about, you know, how do you feel about yourself, and let's, you know, and they're almost like looking at me like, what has that got to do with anything, you mad woman, you know, just like, what do you mean? And but it always circles back to that, like you were saying earlier, in terms of you think of your other relationships and what you're willing to accept and how you think you ought to be treated and the way you interact with other people and all of that sort of stuff. So where it comes from, I don't know, but I'm on this, like, and I say this to clients, I'm on like this mission, this like self-esteem mission with people that come in and sit in front of me, because I think that when you have that relationship with yourself where you respect yourself and you care about yourself and you love yourself, mm-hmm. everything changes.
And it's funny because I was talking to somebody recently and they were saying to me about how just they always needed someone to look after them,
mm-hmm.
and as a result they've always been in unhealthy relationships,
yeah.
you know? So I just asked them, you know, so who was there before this person?
Mm-hmm.
And they mentioned this or some other mm-hmm. person, and then some other person, mm-hmm. and then went all the way back to their mother.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Before your mother, who mm-hmm. was there mm-hmm. to look after you? They couldn't think mm-hmm. that before all these other people, there was they were there.
Mm-hmm.
But they just, they were like, oh yeah, I never thought about it. Mm-hmm. So hang on, me? Take care of me?
Yeah.
Like for this person, it was like completely alien for them to actually realize that actually there was, that they were there from the get-go and they've actually been looking after themselves, you know, getting out of bed, you know, eating, drinking, all the rest and surviving up until, but for some reason they always thought that it was up to somebody else to look after them.
And it's amazing. And that idea that, you know, when you realize that you are in fact perfectly capable, and it's like I said earlier, of not wishing to find fulfillment through another person, so that your relationships become, you know, as well as, you know, in, rather than like instead of, it's not there as to kind of like, as like a prop you up type thing. It's there as a, you know, like an equal kind of partnership.
Because if it's not another person, sometimes it's what you do for a living that then becomes the reason that you're here. You know, what's that saying? You know, we have human beings, not human doings. So, you know, learn to be. You don't have to do. But unfortunately, again, the society we live in, the first thing you ask people is, what do you do, you know?
Yes.
And then that's when you become unemployed, suddenly people's mental health falls apart.
Totally. And there's a huge pressure in that as well, I think, especially with younger people in early 20s figuring out what you're doing. Like we're talking about what to do in college, figuring out with your life. It's like, what do? And if you have to say, like, loads of stuff, but for a living at the moment, you know, nothing, or I don't know. Yeah.
It's status. It's the,
absolutely.
It's just so interesting. When you talk about mental health, it's like... there's still so much that most people wouldn't be aware of how mental health really can impact every single part of your life.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And it's, if only you could look after it, you know, before it falls to pieces, you could really change. But it must be very satisfactory for you to see. And I often, like, I've never entertained the idea of becoming a psychotherapist. I have enough psychotherapists around me. I'm married to one. Yeah. Yay, free therapy.
It's like the same in my household. Like, it's like an episode of Frasier, just like me, my dad. Yeah. You know.
I'm listening. but it must be really satisfactory for you to, or in rewarding even, to see the, you know, the first time a client comes in and sits in front of you and you can see them there, like in a ball of anxiety or whatever, and then see that all kind of unravel and evolve into this. Amazing.
It is amazing, and it's like
front row seat to the transformation of another individual,
which is the most, like, as far as I'm concerned, it's the most worthwhile thing. And it's such, like, it's such a privilege, and it's such a privilege to see somebody, you know, realize that they can do that for themselves, you know, and take that kind of control and take that autonomy and that kind of power. Because I'm just there really to kind of, you know, facilitate. And like, we talk like this, we're talking about, like, you know, there is the kind of psychoeducational piece of, like, talking about whatever it might be, self-esteem and boundaries and all that kind of stuff, but really it's the client that does all of the spade work. And I consider it is my pleasure and my greatest privilege to be able to witness that, because, like you said, people come in and they're they could be in the most vulnerable stage of their life, and so for them to be willing to open up and to do things, you know, to do work and stuff and talk about things that are extremely painful, like, people sometimes think, oh, you know, like we were talking about the stigma there, that they consider it a weakness. And in fact, it's like, it takes major, major guts to be willing to do that and to do it in front of, I mean, it's fine for me to, you know, to sit there and facilitate it, but this is the person that's doing all the work, you know, and it is amazing to be able to see them kind of step into that power of their own and to realize that they can kind of take control of their life. So yeah, it is very rewarding.
It is, because and it's just I don't think people realize just how powerful that work is. You know, because people might say, sure, you see a counselor, and sometimes people laugh about it, sometimes it's a big joke, but people don't realize just how life-changing it is.
Yes.
And but are there misconceptions around what a counselor does? Did you ever find clients coming in saying, Amy, I'm here, can you just
tell me
me
what to do?
Tell me what the problem
all
is
all the time. I feel like I spend half, like, I do, I spend a lot of my life, and it's such a, because counseling, it's like, of course there's methods to it, and this, but it is, how it works for people can often be quite intangible. So yeah, you do spend, you know, sometimes a series of sessions trying to convince people that you're not going to tell them what to do, because they almost don't buy that at the start. And sometimes people will be like, look, I know you're not supposed to tell me what to do,
but just tell me
what to do. you know, and you're like, I can't, and I'm not being obtuse. It's not like I have the answer. I'm just holding on to it selfishly. It's like,
what?
I couldn't.
What do you mean? You don't have a crystal ball?
I know. Everyone's like telling people what to do. It's like, no, not about advice, not about that.
Yeah, because then there's no difference between you and everybody else in their life. Because that's what people do when you talk to a friend, when you talk to a relative, a parent, you know, you tell them your problem. What do you say? Well, this is what you should do.
You ought to do this, And that is, and that's, and it's well-meaning and it's great and you want advice, but that's the difference in the relationship. Because that can be disempowering, you know, that if I would just be another person telling them what to do.
And how does the other person know what's right for you?
Exactly. And how would I know what's right for this person? You know, as in person, they're like, what should I do? And I'm like, I literally just met you. And even if we had been working together for ages, I couldn't possibly tell you what to do. And of course, the nucleus of effective therapy is that is empowerment, is personal autonomy. That's what it is. And so you couldn't have someone telling you what to do because it would defeat the entire purpose of what therapy is.
I just think it's so funny. That is just hilarious. No, because I remember being that client. I remember being that client when I first started my mental health journey in 2006, and everything fell apart. And I was like, I was going to a therapist, and I was going on a weekly basis. And he was like, I felt I was surviving from one therapy session to another. You know, and I suppose what did get, I think, what frustrated me is like I had no idea.
Yes.
Of like how long this would take. How does this work? You know, and I remember being deeply uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And like I felt it almost got worse when I started going to therapy. To the point where he said, maybe this is not working. Maybe I feel like I'm going in the wrong.
It starts opening stuff up and absolutely. Because we want certainty. I think that's
control, Amy. Of course. We want control, but you don't have it.
No, and that's such a huge, because I'm quite candid with my clients and we do a lot of like existential, like as I told you, Irvin Yalom, you know, big fan. But we want that kind of certainty. We want things that are definite. We want a plan. We want things that fit into boxes. And life is just not like that. It's just, you know, everything kind of happening at any time. And then, of course, you realize then through therapy that the one thing you can control is yourself. And that's what you can control. Nothing else. You know, that it's like you want that certainty, but it doesn't really exist. Yeah. You know?
You can't change anything else, but you can change yourself.
Exactly. So learning to live within that kind of, in a world that's very uncertain, I think is a huge part of being a person.
And I still remember being deeply uncomfortable. Hang on, there's no map. There's no.
How long is this going to take? What are you going to do exactly? This is weird. And I always think that people have to kind of get to trust you because I'd say, well, I couldn't. And I always say this to clients, they're like, how long is this going to take? And I said, well, look here, I don't know. I said, I don't want to sound like a really kind of
mystic Meg.
Exactly. And I was like, and I know that you probably think, oh, that's convenient coming from a person who makes their living doing this, but I was like, but genuinely it is impossible to predict how long it takes, and I have to not get sucked into the trap of going, okay, 2 months, 6 months. It's like, because I'd just be, you know,
fibbing.
Exactly. Yeah exactly. It's impossible to know. You can't know.
Oh, it's so funny. I want to laugh. We can laugh about it now because we are on the other side of it, you know, and for people listening to this who aren't on the other side and are still maybe in the thick of it or kind of dipping their toe in it, it is very daunting. But
of course,
but as you and I know, it's so worth it.
Absolutely. And what I often hear from clients is, you know, at the end of it, people come in and they'll admit to me, I'm kind of nervous, and I go, well, why wouldn't you be? Like, you're talking to a total stranger. I understand that, you know. But what I often hear from people at the end, I always check in and I say, have you found your first session? What's it been like? And most people are like, it's not as scary as I thought it was going to be. Because they come in not knowing what you're going to say or do. And, you know, I was like, in lay terms, we're just going to sit here and talk. That's what's going
to
happen.
You're not going to get them to hold hands and sing kumbaya.
It's like, I'm not going to like analyze you the way people think that I am when I'm out for a few pints and they're trying to get me to analyze them. But I was like, it's not like that. We'll just sit and talk. And the large majority of people I see, they always at the end say, that wasn't as scary as I thought it was going to be.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's just so worth it. Anyone listens to that? I think chatting to you has been a great pleasure. But I think people listening to this will know that, I mean, you're just so approachable and so friendly, you know. So, and I think people get that from your website, and I think that's a big draw. And thank goodness that now we have therapists like you, and we have moved away from that kind of type of, you know, being prim and proper, and, you know, and like I remember the therapist who wouldn't even shake your hand.
I think that kind of, like, you know, and again, it's an Irvin Yalom thing, but just that, you know, that the person, the client that sits in front of you, they're the expert in your own life. You know, I'm not the expert. I'm not kind of up here in this kind
authority
of
figure.
Rarefied air, kind of been like, with it all figured out. That's not the way it is, you know, that it's, I think that And I find that it helps me. Obviously, I only know the people that come to me, but that kind of candor that I try to have, and that kind of I try to be approachable. And
it's a joint process, yeah. You know. It's like I'm such a big believer in that. Mm-hmm. You'll only really get somewhere around your own, you know, mental health recovery or transformation, mm-hmm. or whatever you want to call it, is if you take an equal part in the process, and mm-hmm. like you take an active role, part, and like, and now, and then think back when I was existing from one therapy to the session to the next, mm-hmm. you know, I was living with myself 7 days a week and 24 hours a day, so I could have done something on a daily basis to look after my mental health, and that pressure to put that pressure on that one therapist is also not good,
and the 1 hour as well, when you think, because, and I have found that with clients that I see, that I just want to say improve, but whatever someone's looking to get, I always find that the ones that kind of, and I say that to them, like, look, this is only an hour a week. There's 160 whatever hours, you know, to go. So, you know, clients and those of us who actively participate in, you know, our own mental health and what we can do to look after ourselves, you'll see an improvement much quicker. I say to clients, like, it's like going to the gym. Oh, an hour a week, and then be like, what's the hold up? Do you know that kind of way? It's like,
why am I now buffed?
Yeah, it's like, exactly. It's like an hour a week. It's great, but like your life is outside. This is just a little kind of microcosm of life, but your actual life is out there. That's where the change has to be, really. This just kind of starts you off.
Very good. And taking that integrative approach to things, you know, like if you say the analogy of the gym, mm-hmm. You can do that, but then also if you're taking the bus, run for the bus, mm-hmm. you know, or walk mm-hmm. to work, you mm-hmm. know. There's loads of things you can do on a daily basis to look after your mental health. Mm-hmm. So one tip mm-hmm. that people can do on a daily basis to look after their mental health.
My big thing is self-esteem. So my tip for people is to become conscious of their relationship with themselves, become conscious of the way in which they speak to themselves and the way in which they treat themselves, and to nurture and cultivate their relationship with themselves the same way they would with their best friend. So if you're thinking, you know, if you're giving yourself a hard time or whatever, or, you know, you're criticizing yourself for something, just imagine that you were speaking to your best friend or the person that you love most in the world. And if you wouldn't say the thing that you're saying to yourself, if you wouldn't say it to them, don't say it to yourself. So that's my tip. Self-esteem. Permission.
Amy, where can people get in touch with you? What's your website?
So my website is www.amyplanttherapy.com.
Brilliant.
Sounds a little bit like I'm some sort of tree surgeon or something. Yes. It's just my last name.
Horticulturalist.
Like, what is this? But yes, amyplanttherapy.com.
I help people grow.
That should be my... Why did I not put that on a business card? That's like amazing.
That's it. You can have that one for free. So Amy Plant, counselor and psychotherapist here on Spark and Change. Thank you so much for joining us.
It was my pleasure.
Well, we reached the end of this episode. Hope you enjoyed it as much as we did putting it together for you. Don't forget to subscribe, and if you like what you heard, please leave us a review. Spark and Change is brought to you by Insight Matters, counseling and psychotherapy services in Dublin City Centre. They support over 400 clients a week with a team of 45 talented and dedicated counsellors. Visit insightmatters.ie for more information. Do get in touch with the show by emailing us on sparkingchange@headstaff.org or follow me on Twitter @DillW or the show @SparkingChange1. Massive thank you to my researcher, Jamie Reynolds, and the fantastic Headstaff team. So that's it for this episode of Sparking Change. This is Dil Vikramasinghe, and as always, reminding you that we're all part of one human family and that you too can spark change.
This podcast is part of the Headstaff Podcast Network.